Trainer Talks and Tales acknowledges the traditional owners and custodians of the land in which we're recording this podcast, the Turrbal and Yugara people of Meanjin. We pay our respects to elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Trainer Talks and Tales love having an array of guests with a variety of opinions. However, the views of the individuals do not necessarily reflect the perspectives of the host facilities.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Trainer Talks and Tales. You are joined by Tess and Daisy. Daisy, we've just come back from somewhere very exciting. How are you? Are you feeling good after that?
Yes, I am feeling so good. I had such an incredible morning seeing you, and it was so fun to actually record a couple of our episodes in person. So today we had the absolute pleasure of heading down to Paradise Country, which is on the Gold Coast in Queensland. If you have not visited, I definitely recommend. We have shared a fair bit of their training on our social media because they're doing some really cool stuff with animals that you might not necessarily have heard about with training. So we've shared a really cool video about their Tasmanian Devil training and recently more so a koala blood, which was really cool. So we thought we would head down and sort of check out in person some of the training that they chat about all the time, some of the stuff we got to see at the conference as well. What was your favorite sort of part of the day, Tess?
Oh, I actually loved it all. It was so cool. I think seeing it firsthand is different to watching it on a video. So we'd already seen the macropod training, already seen the marmosets, but hadn't seen the meerkat training in person. Oh, well, we did a little bit, but this was a bit more in detail, I guess. Yeah, I loved it all. It was all awesome. What did you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. I always love seeing different sort of animal training, but I also really enjoy spending time with the trainers and the keepers that work there in person as well. It's such a massive community that we talk about a lot on this podcast, and it's really great to have been so welcomed, and they were so friendly and dedicated so much of their time to us, which we're so grateful for. So in this episode, you're going to get to hear from three of their amazing different keepers. So we're starting off with Tabitha. We're actually starting off with Holly. So she's been focusing on a little bit of the meerkat training, which was great. And then we transitioned into chatting with Tabitha all about macropods. And then we're finishing off with Rhiannon, who focuses more on the marmoset troop. So all of them speak about sort of different cooperative care stuff they've been focusing on, some of their training challenges, some of their future training plans. And it was really cool to hear from probably all of them, Tess, I don't know if you agree, but a lot of them utilize sort of their antecedent setup to have a lot of success in their training, which is really cool and really interesting to see what sort of things they're going to have coming in the future too.
Yeah, let's get into it.
Okay, Holly, thank you so much for joining us. And because you're our first keeper, we have stuck you with the fast five. Are you okay if we get straight into that?
Let's go for it.
All right. Number one, dingoes or dogs?
Dingoes.
Coke or Pepsi?
Coke.
Meerkats or marmosets?
Meerkats.
Redback boots or blue steel boots?
Redback.
More satisfying, blowing paths or whippersnippering?
Oh, I'd have to go with leaf blowing.
Yeah. I reckon that was probably the fast five we've actually had in all of our episodes.
You were answering right before I had my last word out. Love it.
Yeah, nice job. Well, Holly, thank you so much for joining us and thank you for being our first guest today at Paradise. We're going to start off today with just maybe learning a little bit more about what a day in the life looks like for you here at Paradise Country.
Yeah, so generally we're a small team that kind of does a little bit of everything. So we start our day usually with a little stand-up brief. The team comes together and the daily suit just lays out what we have in store for the day, any big events, any different things to the routine, any animal health concerns that we might have. It's about 5-10 minutes, then we break into our rounds, visual health checks first and foremost, head counts, exhibit checks, making sure everything structurally as it should be, and then straight into a little bit of food prep, depending on the round, of course, getting all of our encounter food, our pres stuff ready for the day, a couple of hours of good old-fashioned husbandry. And then once we open at around 10 a.m., we're really into our guest interactives for the most part. So lots of different talks and presentations. Now, in between this, we're still doing bits of husbandry, again, depending on the round you're on. We also then have to look at fitting in some training, as well as maybe some project work, whippersnipping, landscaping, lots and lots of different areas that we do cover as a small team. As we get to the afternoon, we start to wind down. We still do our guest interactives pretty much all the way up to nearly closing time, which is 3 o'clock for us. And then, of course, our end of day feed outs, health checks, and getting ready to shut down for the evening.
I've been here a few times, and every time you guys are just running around like headless chooks. I think it's small team, you know, just got so much to do. But yeah, it looks like you guys have a packed day.
We generally do. Yeah. And of course, on a weekday, like most places, a little bit quieter, more your local sort of visitors. But once we get into the weekends and school holidays, we can get well over 1,000, if not higher, which for a small park is quite a big visitation load.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, obviously, you work with our meerkats. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you initially trained your meerkat Rucal?
Yeah, so we have a mob of 4 meerkats. They actually came to us from Rockhampton, already as an established mob and already as a single-sex group, so being all females, mum and 3 daughters. They had some very loose recall training, we were told. They were learning to do encounters there. And so we really capitalized on and just tried to strengthen that behavior. So we started with a group recall with a very simple cue, double tap Miri's, very original. And we actually do that from multiple points around all of the habitat. So at any point the Miri's hear that sound, they respond. And then they've got the verbal cue as well. And then a nice, you know, high value DFI reward for coming to that. We then took it a little bit further, and during our training, we accidentally captured an individual recall with one of our meerkats. So we're now working on potentially getting that out to the other 3 and having a very distinct recall sound along with the syllable of their name, in the hope that we can isolate them for training without, of course, having to separate them from each other. We have another one as well where we do emergency recall. So this one's very much focused in getting them straight back into the den space where we can lock them down and secure them if there is a threat or something foreign has been thrown into the exhibit, which we do unfortunately get quite a lot. So just for their safety, that's a bell. It's a 5-second ring and it's a jackpot reward for those guys. Generally, we allow for about 5 seconds, depending on how far away from the space they are. And every now and then we do find that instinctive sentry behavior will sometimes override. So it might be a little bit longer than that 5 seconds before the last one comes in, so to speak.
We have had a lot of people ask for training terms. So for anyone who hasn't heard of jackpot before, that's just an abundance of food, I imagine.
Yeah, jackpot, and it's usually something they don't get as part of. So when I say DFI, daily food intake, high value for these guys is usually bugs, but it's high fat, high protein. So mealworms, vita worms, those sorts of things.
Good stuff.
Really motivate. A little bit of meerkat McDonald's, we like to call it. And then we might introduce something like a little bit of scrambled egg, peanut butter, a little fuzzy mouse, something very unique and different for those training instances that we're only going to do every so often, but we really want a strong reinforcer to make it sort of worth their while. Come on in.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. I really love how you focus on 2 different types of recall. That can be quite difficult for a lot of animals to be able to distinguish between an emergency and a standard recall. So that's really impressive that you've been able to establish that. You did mention a little bit about working with your animals individually for the recall. And I'm pretty aware that meerkats are fairly social and quite a complex species.
Yeah.
Do you generally separate your mob for training or do you utilize the whole group?
No, so we don't like to separate our animals. Where we do, it's in pairs, so they've always got a buddy, and it's always within sight of each other. So a very social species. We do have individuals that are closely bonded, so if we separate them, we see a lot of frustration behaviours, and we don't want to, you know, bring that about basically unnecessarily. So for training, we initially started having a very small mob. It's actually quite easy. I only have 4 meerkats to contend with, not 20. We had 4 trainers and we would train all together at once, focusing on our individual animal. That's not always practical. And then trainers come and go, staff move on. Mm-hmm. So we've had a little bit of a shift recently. So capturing that individual recall, popping a little bit of enrichment out, not too exciting, but just enough to keep the other 3 entertained, mm-hmm. but keep the focus of the individual you're working on you, has been really successful. We can, of course, split them in pairs with 2 trainers or enrichment for the 2 that are participating and focus on the 2, but they still have full visibility of each other.
I was going to say, that's pretty impressive if you can get 4 staff for each meerkat.
It doesn't happen often. Yeah, I was like, wow, that was one of our challenges. We learned pretty quickly that's not going to work.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, you sometimes forget how separating them can actually be a big deal. I always think that you separate an individual for training, but meerkats would not prefer that. They would like to have a buddy.
So they have taken to the pair separation quite well, as long as there's sight and contact. But of course, the training sessions depend on so many external factors. And the minute the behavior shifts and they disengage or there's something else and they need to be together, slides opened and it's full access. Training is just called off.
Makes sense. Now, what has been the hardest behavior to maintain with the meerkats?
probably full body tactile. So mm-hmm. you guys know they're not a species that likes to be touched.
Yeah.
So we introduced it for a few reasons, health being the primary one, being able to have our vet come in, sit down, handle, like I said, not handle, but touch all over, you know, put hands or fingers on feet, nose, face, all the body, back, tail, belly, all those sorts of things. Really helpful. That way we're not capturing, we're not restraining, we're not having a stressful experience for the animal, and our vet can get the assessment they need. Now, videos, of course, also a really good way of doing our health checks, but also too, when we have our guest interactions, people's first response for any animal, doesn't matter how many times you tell them, please don't put your fingers towards a meerkat, they go to reach and they go to grab and they go to pat. So a little bit of desensitization for that as well. So if there is an unexpected guest sort of interaction, the meerkats generally don't react to that, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, a better outcome for them and also for our guest safety as well.
How often do you generally do that tactile training to try and maintain?
So okay, every keeper is trained to every morning when they're released out of their den space onto exhibit, they'll generally come out in a line and they'll go on full bipedal back on their tail and they'll bask. So that's your opportunity. You've got that few minutes there to offer some food, do a full tactile with each and have a really good look in the sun for the first time that day.
I love that. Using the light to get the best view.
And they're also seizing the opportunity when they're all like, oh yeah, like in the sun.
And it's kind of, they're warming and they're very routine and they have their times of day. After that, they go straight into digging and they're distracted. They're not interested in what we're doing. The challenge has been probably rapport. So meerkats, especially our girls, take a lot to learn to trust that touch behavior. So when we have a change in the team or new staff coming in, things that one keeper might be able to do with the four of them suddenly isn't met with the same willingness or voluntary participation. It might be a bit more startled, you know, could be a bit more teethy even. So we really just have to take our time with that and get the keepers building a really good rapport before we start introducing. And the same for our vet team.
Yeah, absolutely. So
in terms of challenges, it's still ongoing, like years in.
Yeah, for sure. I think like maintaining that is so important and so like it's so beneficial for the meerkat's welfare to keep that maintenance with those staff as well.
Yeah.
Obviously, you have trained a huge variety of different behaviours with your meerkats, which is amazing, and a pretty big team or varied team that can work across them. So how do you ensure that your team are using the most efficient and least intrusive way when it comes to training?
Yeah, so we're actually just taking a bit of a shift, moving away from that ideal for people, for animal scenario, and bringing in a behaviour board. So basically every day of the week we'll have however many four behaviours, let's say, and they'll be completed and established behaviours, and our newer keepers will just focus on maintenance of those behaviours, and then we'll have some primary keepers bringing in the new behaviours we'd like to see moving forward. They'll just indicate what behaviours have been done, but also what conditioning has been done. We have two very distinct things we do every day, so just a bit of desense to catch equipment, pet packs, all that other sort of stuff we might need to do, and then basically picking a time of day, our keepers learn a lot about the species, their activity patterns, what they would do in the wild, what their routine is here with us, when's an appropriate time, when are they likely to get a higher engagement response, what's going on externally, what's going on in the environment, what's going on in the surrounds of our park, and picking their moment to go in and set that session up, hopefully for success, but also knowing to walk away and to maybe try again a bit later if it's just not going to work in that instance. So we really work with the mob. We feed off them what they're doing. We go to them. All our training sessions are portable. So is all of our equipment. Mm-hmm. So everything we do can go to the animal. We don't have to recall them into a designated space.
Yeah. It sounds like you quite hugely rely on having a good antecedent setup that has been successful for choosing like the sun when they're basking and definitely when the best time of day to have the most success. Yeah.
And like, we are so lucky. Our meerkat habitat is purpose-built just for the species. It holds potentially over 20 animals. We've got four, you know, they use every space within it. They explore everywhere. So we can kind of, so comfortable in it that we can pretty much just adapt and go to where they are at that particular time.
That's really cool. We saw some training last year and it was really awesome to see. The sun was coming down though, and you could tell
fighting the the wind down response. That was the AZSK. It was a little bit challenging, I think, for the third and fourth group. The meerkats just went to bed and went, thanks for coming.
Yeah.
You should have been here earlier.
Yeah.
Now we have one more question, which was actually sent in from a listener.
Sure.
What is their favorite type of enrichment?
They really like, I guess, tactile. So think a big ball pit, either the colored balls, scrunched up or shredded paper, anything that rummages, lots of dry, crunchy brows, and the bigger the better. And they all just throw themselves in. Even our dominant female Aya, who's quite reserved and quite shy and scared of a lot of new things, will just jump in like she's a little meerkat again, having the time of her life. And it just makes me smile because she's like, she lets go of all her inhibitions and responsibility and just gets in there and has a good time.
That's so good.
Obviously that's paired with food. They are exploratory and they do look curious, but generally it's all food driven for these guys.
Yeah.
So that's a little snack in the bottom.
Love to see meerkats in full fish.
I can set one up later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Holly, that was awesome. Thank you so much for being our first guest sharing everything about meerkats.
Thank you.
Okay. Hi, Tabitha. Thank you so much for joining us. You excited?
Yes, I'm super excited.
Yay. This is so good. We're really excited to chat a little bit more about macropods. So to start off your chat, we would love to maybe hear a little bit more about your role at Paradise and how you got to be here.
Wonderful. I've only just been here just under 2 years, 2.5 if you count my time in nursery that I did. But my journey started when I was just a little teeny bopper at Currumbin as a teen volley. I did that for a couple of years and then I moved to Rockhampton and volunteered at the Rockhampton Zoo for a couple of years and then moved back down to the Gold Coast to do my internship through TAFE. I interned at SeaWorld and Paradise Country, where Paradise Country offered me an awesome position there in the nursery. I utilised my time brilliantly in the nursery for around 6 months until curator Lauren pulled me to wildlife. I've worked my way up in wildlife, working with the macropods, which has absolutely stolen my heart. I work with the koalas as well as the birds and reptiles, and I've recently just started in with the marmosets.
They're the dingoes in the background, if anyone is wondering.
We're really on tour.
Why there's wailing in the background. It's dingoes.
That's a coon and a lyra.
That's adorable.
Wow, it sounds like you've had a great journey in such a short time.
They might be upset that I haven't started working with them yet.
But I've also only heard good things about you too. Like, we've met you briefly doing your training sessions with the macropods, but last year at the conference, but everyone has said that you've just flourished and really just put so much effort into your role. So congratulations to you.
Thank you. The conference was huge. That was what was in my first year of zookeeping, and it's just mind-blowing just starting to work with the kangaroos to just see how far they can go. It's just insane.
Yeah, and we actually saw that firsthand. So we saw your kangaroo training when we visited and it was awesome. I was so inspired. I took so many videos. I took it back to my sanctuary, and even little things like the comms with the
The Kong puzzle feeder. Yeah, it just has pellets in it. Shotgun. Yeah.
And all that stuff. I was like, I've never seen this before. And so I took a lot of inspiration from that. Can you tell us a little bit more about the training and what were some of the goals when you started that training program?
Yeah, of course. So previous zookeepers and trainers have started the fundamentals to it. So like Jess Line and Chloe Smith, they started the target training and a lot of the tactileness. I saw an opportunity to help with the cooperative care and reduce of GAs to reduce the physical restraint and the sedation for it. Also to work on cognitive skills and the enrichment for them as well as developing those trust and rapport between the animals. So for voluntary bloods to voluntary injections is just huge for the kangaroos due to like myopathy and stress. It's just really reducing all of that dramatically. So we do have an aging population. I saw a chance to just help with the reduce of their ever-growing stress on them, and I flew with that.
It's amazing. And like, I completely second what Tess said. It's training is amazing, but to see it on animals that are probably not involved in all the training is just generally so much more impressive.
Yeah.
I think it's so cool to be able to work around those challenges that you get with those animals. And one challenge that I know might maybe have come up is obviously kangaroos are generally quite a flighty species. Mm. How did you best kind of mitigate that with training? Did you find it was a particular of a challenge? Or?
So we've mitigated that by utilizing when they are most going to be active and choose to participate in that session. We've also made sure that sessions are short and positive for them. And we also do preference testing for them as well. So to help calm them down, we find the best way to get them to hang around and want to hang around with us as well. Working on their tactability as well has been amazing. So for them to be able to be touched in places that they're not usually, like on their legs and holding off their veins, it's quite helpful for that as well. But in the fact that we can't control those outside forces, so if they need to be flighty for a reason of a danger, or if shotgun, our dominant male, goes to the other side of the paddock, then we're going to allow them to go. We're not going to stop them in every way. But also, if it's just a spook, then we can come back and we can try again a little bit later. It just depends on the means of their flightiness, really. Also having that cooperative care, we've also got them on a recall. So if they do choose to come back and do it, that's also going to calm them down on their next training session. We always do try and end on that positive note. So some of our sessions will only be 2 minutes. So if they get frustrated and they want to go, then they can go. And then we'll just take that onto our approximations and we will reduce it for next time as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like it's really cool. And I think it's super important in training that you are very aware of the natural instincts of an animal that you're working with.
Yeah.
And obviously that's something that you guys are really aware of, and it's reflecting in your training and still allowing those animals to leave if they're not feeling comfortable for, you know, X, Y, and Z reasons. And then if they choose to come back, great, we can continue the session, which is awesome. You've had success with that.
It has been great. We do have those times as well for Yoda. He was doing amazing one-on-one, and then we've introduced our vet nurse, and just having that second person there, he's just taken a step back. He's like, whoa, like I didn't know I'd be crowded here. So he was naturally flighting in that instinct as well. Having two people there, we found out that instead of standing in front of Yoda to reinforce him, if we stand a little bit to the side of him, it allows him just to have that a little bit more space. Mm-hmm. So if he wants to go, he just doesn't feel as enclosed in as well. Ash and I, our vet nurse, have taken a step back in our approximations as well. So that just has reduced him. We've pretty much started fresh. He was doing great with one person, but now we've got two. We found out his natural, there's the boundary, and we won't cross that until he is ready.
Yep.
So yeah, helping that flightiness, it is completely customized to each individual kangaroo. We have 17 at the moment, and they each have the most dramatic personality changes. From our Princess Pearl that has been our successful girl, we've taken her bloods in November, to Shotgun, who's so hand tactile. He's the one that loves the wobbler, and I'll give him my treat pouch, treats or not in it. It's just whatever works for him, and it just changes.
Yeah.
Sorry, I also should note our preference testing. We've gone from, when we first started this, I put messages out to a lot of people asking for what do you use for reinforcement. I can't find a reinforcement that is strong enough for them. People have suggested peanuts, peanut butter, honey. We've gone the complete circle around, and their best reinforcement to help them just be okay is their pellets that they get three times a day. They just sit there and they're like, yeah, chill. And if they're flighty, I was like, hey, I've got some treaties. And they're like, oh, yeah, cool. And he will come back for that. Yeah. Three times a day, but that treat pouch, he's like, you've got treats. Yeah.
We love that. Anything fancy. Yeah. Like, the general diet.
Yeah.
We've seen that before with like training sessions just being with the hay that they're normally given. It's really cool to know that that's reinforcing in itself.
And then every other day, like I can bring in different, like orange juice in a syringe or some honey, or looking at with peanut butter and honey on it, and they'll take. But during training session, they love their pellets. They're like focused on those pellets.
And that's when you want that high value reinforcement.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. Yeah.
So you've mentioned a little bit about what you guys have been doing. So there's some tactile training,
yeah,
some voluntary blood draws.
Yes.
And some target training.
Yes.
What is next for the Macropod training program?
So I really want to work on that tactability for them. I want to put out the voluntary bloods for the rest of them as well. And you can never stop target training. So at the moment I'm doing something called full extension, which gets them to the target training, stand up and hit the target pole as high as they possibly can. That way I can check under all of them. I can hold the females to a full extension so I can check in the pouch. All of our boys, we do have a closed population at the moment, so we're not looking in the pouch for any babies, but it's just to make sure that there's no wounds, that they're keeping it clean and things like that. We'd also like to work on their recall training that little bit as well. And Look, they are weight trained, but we have the issue of our scales being that little bit, it's not an issue, it's a challenge, of the scales being that little bit too small for them as well. So once they hop onto the scales, we can get them on that full extension on there as well.
Yeah. I like it. Yeah, and I like how you're using the target that's already conditioned to work towards the tactile, because I guess by utilizing that target, it's a very, you know, least intrusive for the tactile initially, and then you can start building up with that actual.
I'd actually like to take that target that little bit further as well. I'd like to get a second one with a bell ball attached to it, so I can send them to a second keeper that can ring them, and I say go, and then the second keeper can ring it. So on conditions like weight training, I can get Gizmo on it, for example, and then send him to someone else. Gizmo is very clicked on with the weight training, and he gets a little bit possessive over it. So if I can send him somewhere else,
so others can have a turn.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah.
No, that sounds really exciting. Now, we do have one final question, which is our listener question for you.
Amazing.
Now, you spoke a little bit about reinforcers, but someone has asked, what are any other good training reinforcers if they are not motivated by food?
Oh, brilliant question. One that actually comes up quite a bit as a challenge to us. The reinforcers change every day, every session. I found that neck scratches or chest scratches goes a huge distance. Ear scratches in Malibu, yeah, sometimes, but that chest, when they really get their neck up, they love. Shotgun, for example, that empty treat pouch, even though it has nothing in it, he's so tactile with his hands, he just loves digging stuff up. So a Kong Wobbler, a toy, an empty treat pouch, it's just beautiful for him.
That's so cool. Yeah. And I think we can all picture a kangaroo getting really good.
Yeah. It's my favorite thing.
Like 180.
They bend it all the way.
Well, it's so clear how incredibly passionate you are for kangaroos. So it's been so lovely chatting to you, and we're looking forward to coming to meet your mom.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you for your time. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Are you happy if we get started with our very first question?
Let's do it.
All right, Rhiannon, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and the Marmoset troop that you get to work with?
So I actually started in the zookeeping industry back in 2003. I worked in a couple of facilities up in Far North Queensland. One of them was both natives and exotics, and then the second one was all exotics. And then now I'm here at Paradise Country. Our marmoset troop, we actually have 15 marmosets, so quite a large troop. We have 7 males, 6 females, and 2 unsexed at the moment. Mine and Inca, mum and dad, are both 7 years of age, and going down to our youngest, Davido and Chera, who just turned 1. It's quite an interesting dynamic, an interesting troop. They've all got their own personalities, definitely.
How old do they have to be before you can sex them?
About a year of age.
Okay, so soon.
Yes.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, Tess and I have spoken a lot about this conference, but we were really lucky to see some of the amazing training that you've done, and especially the recall training that you did. What was your sort of main motivator behind starting that training?
Yeah, I have to give special mention to Courtney Hawkins as well. She definitely pioneered our marmoset training here. So I definitely want to thank Courtney for that. The recall training we had in mind for that, if we needed to, for whatever reason, move the troop for a safety reason, that could be something like maybe there's a cane toad, or it could be something that there's structural damage. We wanted to try and get them to a, whether it's back of house, as efficiently as possible. And it also helps if we need to, for whatever reason, shift the animals for husbandry or exhibit maintenance as well. They responded really well to the training. We were able to pretty much get the training of the recall down in honestly about 3 to 4 sessions. So they did really well. And for that, we use a high value item, and we use mealworms for that one.
Their favorite for enforcement.
Yes, I'm guessing. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Favorite. So for the recall, that's the only time that we use mealworms for that. Yeah. So yeah. So they respond really well. And so we continue that training with the recall, and we do it at different times. So for example, we could do it first up when their breakfast has been put out. We could do it late in the afternoon, different times of the day, different weather environments, just so if we do have to use that recall, that they're used to not having it at a particular time.
Yeah, that's great. I think that variability is so, it's really interesting. And 100%. they'll leave their breakfast to come to the mealworms.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's definitely very reinforcing.
And they can pretty much, if we have marmosets at the far end of the exhibit and we're wanting them to come to our back of house area, they can do that in about 10-second period.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's really, really great.
It's a successful recall.
Definitely. So, yeah.
Now, we understand it can be tough training animals in social groups.
Mm-hmm.
How do you still ensure a successful session when working with a large troop?
So, obviously, with our troop, we have some of the marmosets who are quite confident, always keen to come down and do training. We have some that are a little bit more reserved. So with that, if we're using a small equipment, for example, it might be the target stick or their station, we find that we may get a couple of marmosets that may sort of come around the individual that we're training at the time. So it's not actually too bad then. When we use our induction box, we find that it is easier to have two of the keepers in and we can train at the same time, but also we could probably add in some enrichment items just so then all of the marmosets sort of have that opportunity to have that training, making sure that it's positive for them and that it reduces any frustration that we may find, because especially with things like the induction box being marmosets, they love to sort of climb in those sort of items, so they all want to have a go. So yeah, so using two keepers and, like I said, adding some enrichment items in definitely helps for that particular behavior that we're training.
Is most the aggression that you generally see around food, or is it in other situations as well?
I wouldn't say it's aggression. I think for our troop, we have some that are just super keen and are always just they're wanting to do that training. So it's just being able to add in, example, like the enrichment items or adding in another keeper where we can sort of separate that. And we, one of us may be with some marmosets that are super keen, and there could be one that does want to come down just a little bit more reserved, but can still do the behavior, but they're just a little bit more reserved than some of the other marmosets.
Yeah, awesome. Now, aside from your recall, what sort of cooperative care behaviours do you focus on with your marmoset troop?
So between keeper and the species, we do things like tactile during our health checks. We also do microchip scanning as well, the induction box, stationery, and we do this so it can reduce the need for capture and restraint for those guys. At all times, our marmosets have choice and control whether they want to participate in any of our training at all. So we just sort of feed off them, basically. If they're sort of busy eating at that stage, we can just then come back later and then see if they're interested. Cooperative care between the actual troop itself, we occasionally introduce a troop bonding experience, and that could be one of our, for example, we could walk our dingo pups past, and that basically strengthens the troops just in case there's a dynamic shift towards a potential breakdown as well. So
that's cool. Yeah, I've never heard of that.
So we only use it when required, and it's only if it's potentially going to a breakdown as well. So so we just walk our dingo pups just past the exhibit. Obviously they have no contact with the marmosets at all. So we use that, so then the troop comes together, their natural behavior comes together as a troop, protecting each other and their alert calls.
So you're kind of using an inversive stimulus to improve the troop dynamic.
And as I said, it's only used
Wow, that's really impressive. How much of your day is spent towards training with the troop?
So there's myself and another keeper, so we have as 15 marmosets trying to train. We've got about 8 different behaviors, so we basically spread that out between us over the week. So we'll go in and today it might be, okay, I'm going to do station training with five of them and also microchip scanning. So we just alternate it, again, changing the time of day that we do all of the training. It could be early morning, late afternoon, just again, to keep it different for them as well. So yeah, we just spread it out between us. It makes it a lot easier as well.
Yeah. Keeps it really varied as well.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Now we have one more question, which was sent in from a listener. What future behaviours would you like to achieve with the trip?
So we've actually just started the ultrasound scanning with them. So they're quite used to, well, we've got them to the stage where they're used to being tactile on their abdomen region. And I've just built a little contraption of a stand. So hopefully we can get them all to individually stand and have their hands on the bar, so then we can have the abdomen being scanned there. That's the aim.
Yeah.
We'll see how that goes.
Aim high.
Exactly. But again, with marmosets, all 10 of them wanted to do it at once. Yeah. So
you need like a keeper for each.
Exactly right. Impossible. And that's the thing. We have some that are, like I said before, some that are a little bit more reserved, and then some that just as soon as you come in, you start training, they all want to do it. So I think it's just being able to give them all that time to be able to do each of those behaviours. But yeah, they're definitely a smart troop for sure.
I look forward to seeing that video.
Yes, definitely. Stand by.
Yeah.
We were so impressed with all that training. So we can't wait to see what you guys do.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us.
That's right. Thank you for having
me. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah. Tess, that was such a special episode and so much fun chatting to all three of the keepers today and seeing and hearing all about some of their epic training that they're doing at Paradise.
Yeah, I think it's very engaging having three different people talking on this episode too. So hope you guys enjoyed it as much as we did. We're very grateful to Paradise Country for all the behind the scenes organizing this episode too, and obviously to those lovely keepers for spending some time with us. So hope you guys enjoyed it, and we'll be back in your ears next week.
See you soon.